you very much for being with us, Yves Mersch. My name is David Marsh. I'm the chairman of ONFIF. It's a great pleasure to be with Yves Mersch today. You are, I think it can be said, one of the grand old men now of European central banking, since you've been on the governing council now continuously for 22 years. And I believe you've attended in that time about 530 governing council meetings. So that's something like between 20 and 25 a year. Not every one of them, of course, has been a decision-making meeting, but you've had a ringside seat in the ups and downs of the euro over that period of time. And you were, as the governor of the Central Bank of Luxembourg, and then before that, director of the Luxembourg Treasury, you were very much involved in the whole build-up to the Maastricht Treaty in the Netherlands in 1991. So you go back a long way. And in this conversation, we're going to be talking about some of the longer-term issues, as well as some of the shorter-term perspectives, what will happen in December before you leave your office after this extraordinary period of 22 years and your 8 years as board member. First of all, looking back at that broad sweep of the ups and downs, the things that you've got right and the things that you've got wrong, what stands out as the overall balance sheet, would you say, Mr. Mersch, of the ECB over that time? We've got used to hearing about the ECB being work in progress. What needs to be completed still?
Well, we all know that if you are a young institution, you learn, and you learn also more rapidly. And I think that has been a characteristic of the ECB. And by and large, I think the ECB under the different presidents has also managed to support the euro and also the European integration. And obviously, some of the difficult part has been that the completion of the European Monetary and Economic Union has not been completed as fast as we had expected it to be when we negotiated the Maastricht Treaty. And even today, it is an incomplete architecture. And some of the pillars have been halfway erected, but not fully completed, like in the banking union. We also would need to get further support from the capital markets union, to just mention a few. There will be discussion on the fiscal side as well. But that, of course, would also mean that we would need to look at the treaties again, because you cannot all the time heap more competences at the European level without also reinforcing the democracy at the European level at the same time.
It's very important that you say that, because after all, one of your jobs now on the board is to be in charge of legal services. We are in the middle, of course, of an extraordinary pandemic still, and a grave crisis in Europe, as we are in the rest of the world. Do you subscribe to this notion of Jean Monnet that Europe needs crises to bring it forward, and that the ECB can actually profit from this crisis, if it plays its cards right, by amassing the necessary instruments to overcome the challenges we now face?
Well, you know, I usually quote rather Robert Schuman than Jean Monnet, but by and large, I would not disagree that if you are in an incomplete architecture, it is through failures that you get up and take the next step forward. The positive thing is that through all the difficult experiences, we have only headed in one direction, and that is the direction of further integration and more solidarity among European nations. And I think that is positive. And we have also strengthened the European institutional setup during the same time. All this gives me hope for further strength of the European Union. And if today some people speak of a European sovereignty, don't forget that if you would have used such words 30 or 20 years ago, you would have been the laughingstock. Today, it goes without saying, many European statesmen, head of nation states, use the word European sovereignty. And it is well understood, increasingly well understood by our populations as well.
in the speech that you made to OMFIF 10 years ago, you gave a speech to us to commemorate the work of Pierre Werner and the Werner Report in 1970. And then you spoke about the need for an independent fiscal authority in Europe that would actually bring up the question of sovereignty in a big way. Do you think we're actually closer to that vision now than we were 10 years ago?
A little bit closer than 10 years ago, not yet there where it would be fully efficient. Let me say that a European institution exists in so far that we have the European Financial Board that is headed by Professor Tigerson. It is an advisory board, of course, only. But we also have in the meantime made further strides into the direction of having common programs, like, for example, the one that is now being implemented and rolled out to fight the pandemic. And I think this is also not to be underestimated as a big step forward because that has been resisted for many decades and is now a reality. I know that this afternoon the ambassadors will still have to decide whether this is being sent for ratification to all the parliaments in the present form. But nevertheless, we have made progress even in the area of fiscal policy. It is true, as you say, that fiscal policy is the essence of a national sovereignty and of parliament's rights to control government. And from that point of view, if you would transfer some of such rights at the European level, you would at the same time need to transfer some powers also to the European Parliament. And in order to transfer it to the European Parliament, you would also need to make the democratic functioning of the European Parliament, I would say, more efficient and more in line what is expected from a true democracy. The whole issue, however, would also be how would the other areas of policy making at the executive level be affected by such transfer of a power that is usually associated with a nation to the European level. We know that we are a construct that has no comparable construct around in the world. And we are, to some extent in Europe, trying to preserve the nation state and also transfer a higher degree of integration at the European level, a higher degree of integration than the pure international cooperation, as it is the case in an international organization. We are, so to some extent, we give direct rights to our citizens already today at European level, which would not work for an international organization, which always has to go through the government in order to give benefits or obligations.
So what you're saying is that we would indeed, in order to get to that higher stage, we would need some treaty change as well as the overriding government will. How likely do you think, given the present constellation in Europe, might need referendums in a number of countries? You might need even to change the German constitution for this, which would itself need a referendum. How politically realistic is this idea of a treaty change?
I am perfectly aware that there is no great appetite within the governments to have such a situation, as it also involves different time lags from one country to another. And everyone knows that the time lags involve uncertainty because external political shocks could also hit the country in the meantime, or economic shocks for the purpose. And that makes treaty change all the more difficult in a time where there has been a mounting wave on antagonism and populism in our democracies. And as long as our democracies would not have been further stabilized through economic growth, there is probably not the highest level of appetite going into such a direction unless the amount of the crisis and the depth of the crisis and the risk coming with new crisis is such that it is perceived as the only way out. Don't forget
that would not be a very palatable alternative, would it, to have a deepening of the crisis? That might be asking a bit too much to bring about this change in circumstances that you're thinking about.
Yeah, but don't forget that the program of the present commission also includes treaty change and looking at the treaty. So it is not something that is seen as a very easy way, but it is certainly not something that is totally excluded by our present leaders.
Good. Just two more questions about the past before we get on to the immediate future. One is that if you look back, do you think a major milestone was the Draghi Do What It Takes speech, which he undertook slightly quixotically in London, of all places, in July 2012? Was that for you, looking back over the 22 years that you've been on the Governing Council, was that the turning point, or would you like to suggest another event?
I would say if you point at the individual events, it was certainly a very determining event in the history of the persistency of the euro. I would say maybe another important event was when it was decided to keep the euro area together, also by giving support to one country which was in a deep crisis by then.
Which was Greece in 2015.
Correct. And that was a moment where there was in the markets perceptions that the Europeans would not be able to get their act together. But as I said, as always in crisis, Europe is at its best. Unfortunately.
Just a question about Mr. Draghi in 2012. You must have been as taken aback as everybody else. You were somewhat surprised. He certainly took Mr. Weidmann by surprise. Or did you know all about the speech in advance?
Well, even those who were writing the speech were taken by surprise, because this was also a very personal input by President Draghi at that moment. But it proved his very thorough and deep understanding of the functioning of financial markets. And from that point of view, from the point of view of the perception in the financial markets, I think he struck the right tone at the right moment in the right place.
No, that's a very good answer. Going into the immediate future, we have the Pandemic Emergency Purchase Programme, an extraordinary bout of asset purchases, which was decided in March, has been stocked up in the meantime. Do you think that the gravity of the crisis is still serious enough to justify continuing that programme, not only into 2021, but beyond June 2021, when at present it is due to run out?
We will inform at the moment we have taken decisions. What we have said is that we will recalibrate all our instruments. The word recalibration, an equivalent is rectifying, trying to adjust to the present circumstances. So I will not give, like maybe others prefer to do, my personal preference. I will reserve my personal preference to the decision-making body in which I have had the pleasure and the honor to participate over 22 years. What is true is that our instrument toolbox has been extremely diversified and has served us well. It has served us well because it was diversified. It was able to be calibrated to different situations, to changing circumstances, and if need, able to evolve. And we will continue in the same spirit to try to live up to our responsibilities. And in the present crisis, don't forget that the toolbox that we have extended was the PEP and the TLTRO III. This pandemic emergency purchase program was specifically geared towards meeting the consequences of such a pandemic. And it is not to be mixed up with our normal toolbox or our past purchase programs. And the same goes for our liquidity providing instruments that we have added. And we will continue to see whether, in view of the newest data that will be provided to us in terms of economic projections, looking much closer at the depths of the second wave and the confinement measures, but also taking into account the much faster fiscal response that we have seen at the national level, but also on top at the European level. So all this has to be factored in into our new projections, which already our last projections had already foreseen that we would have a second wave. What it did not foresee at that moment was, first, the strength of the uptick in the third quarter, and second, the strength of the downtick now probably in the fourth quarter. But we have...
Yes, there's a lot to, there's a lot you'll have to look at in December, which will, I think, be your last meeting, won't it? You mentioned fiscal policy. Are you, rather like the Federal Reserve, are you actually calling on the fiscal authorities in Europe to carry on the accommodation? And then that would mean that you, as the central bank, do not have to do all the heavy-duty lifting. You don't have to be any longer the only game in town, because the fiscal authorities will be doing their bit. Is that something that you and your colleagues on the Governing Council are now actively calling for?
We are trying to be the most efficient. What monetary policy can do is giving liquidity support, and also to try to keep the liquidity flowing into the economy. That is what we are good at and where our instruments are being geared to. But then you have also other factors that are the consequence of a pandemic, where fiscal policy is probably more effective. And that is what also the Governing Council has recognized. And that's why we are believing that we are pulling on the same side of the string. And we will be much more efficient and effective at European level if we continue to do that. And since the pandemic is not yet over, at least not the second wave, it would be appropriate that we would continue to have efficient fiscal policy, also supporting the monetary policy accommodation that we have given in maintaining financial conditions that are quite accommodative.
We had also some interesting comments at the International Monetary Fund World Bank meetings in October, under which the IMF is basically saying, not just in Europe but elsewhere around the world, governments should get on with the business of issuing debt. They should borrow as much as they can at the moment because interest rates are very low, and therefore this can be done. Are you worried that this could lead to a condition of fiscal dominance, under which the central banks in the future won't be able to raise interest rates to the manner justified, because it could plunge the governments into such a payments crisis that the central banks will become very unpopular and possibly lose their independence? This was sketched out by Jens Weidmann and others. Do you share that worry, Mr. Mesh?
I do not share it, because fortunately we are not here to be popular, but we are here to do the job for which we have been created, and that is to deliver on price stability. That is our priority objective, and in order to implement it, we have at constitutional level been given independence, and we have at constitutional level been told that we cannot do monetary financing. So all these suggestions of debt forgiveness, they are simply undermining the efficiency of a functioning monetary union, because they will in the end increase the very spreads that we have been trying to keep under control, at least as far as they would arise from considerations of a monetary union not being holding together anymore. But I do not consider that fiscal dominance is a threat now, because we are rowing into the same direction with fiscal policy. It is true that if in the future there would be a reversal of price developments, we will have to be true to our priority objective. And that is only one. So from that point of view, if we say that fiscal policy for the moment is more effective, that does not mean that we do not also say that the sustainability, medium-term sustainability of public finance is still an important objective to keep in the back of your head. But for the moment, with interest rates at a level that is lower than growth, there is no major concern of further fiscal action.
So you're saying that in the future, after you've left the Governing Council, the ECB has to be ready to take unpopular decisions and raise rates. It's obviously not done that in the last 8 or 9 years, ever since Mr. Draghi took over. Do you think that the ECB would have the strength in order to do that? And then linking that to the recent Fed decisions about average inflation rates targeting, do you think that the ECB itself would be willing to let the inflation rate go up beyond 2% in future and not raise rates in that eventuality?
I'm quite sure that the institutional strength of the institution to act in accordance with its mandate is sufficient also in the future to defend what it was created for. As to the strategy, I think we are still in the midst of discussing it. You mentioned one possibility of changing the strategy. There are many arguments that are pleading against adopting such a target. We have sufficient flexibility with our medium-term orientation. We have also decided that we dislike inflation as much as we dislike deflation. And from that point of view, we said that we would have symmetry, but symmetry does not mean that we would engage in any kind of makeup to compensate for past inflation. And because we have not had inflation for 6 years or 8 years, we would now have inflation run away for the next 8 years before we would act. I think that is not the way we understand our mandate,
well, that's
and that
a very
is not
important
the way
statement.
That our strategy is right now.
Well, that's a very important statement that you're making. So you would not take into effect the fact that you've been undershooting, say, for the last 6 years. That would not be part of the calculation in your mind.
There has already now been a possibility within our present strategy to have sufficient flexibility to have a detailed analysis of the trend of inflation and the origin of such a trend. If it would be due to outside factors like energy prices or food prices, which are outside our control, we already now and in the past did not automatically and rigidly react against it. So that is already a possibility within our present mandate, and there is no need to adjust the mandate, our medium-term orientation in the mandate, to be economically reasonable in the future when there would be inflation picking up again. It would be quite different if the origin of inflation would be coming from other areas, and where we would very quickly see that there would be a risk of disanchoring of inflationary expectations, and that would prompt us not to allow for a very long time to have such an overshooting.
Well, thank you for making that point clear, even though it will be something that your successors will have to deal with. Well, I hope we can indeed invite you over to London. I do hope that will be possible next year. I hope to see you again physically as well as across the screens.
Thanks a lot for inviting me. I stay loyal to all the friends and the institutions.
Thank you very much. All the best.